evening on Focus on Community. Glad that you could be with us this evening. My name is Lori Scandling. I'm a volunteer here at KTOO, and this evening our program will focus on the placement of the statue on July 3rd in front of the courthouse honoring former Secretary of State William H. Seward. We have a number of guests with us this evening, both by telephone and live in our studios. I'd like to welcome our guests. They include Assemblymember Mary Becker, who began the process with other local people of bringing to fruition the placement of the statue of William Seward. Also with us is Ishmael Hope, a local activist in our community, Wayne Jensen, who is on the Alaska State Historical Commission and is a Juneau architect, much involved, and now co-chair of the committee to bring the William Seward statue to Juneau, and Dr. Norma Shorty, who is an independent Indigenous researcher. By telephone this evening, we'll have sculptor David Rubin from Ketchikan, and we have an interview pre-recorded today with Mike Dunham, who is an author about Seward called The Man Who Bought Alaska, and he has a companion book called The Man Who Sold Alaska. Thank you all for being here this evening. Just to help our readers frame the history of William Seward and when he lived, he was born in 1801 in New York and grew up there at a time when the conversations about the expansion of our country, as well as the issue of slavery, raged throughout his formative years. He was trained as a lawyer. He served in the New York legislature. He later was a two-term governor of New York and then became a United States senator when selected by his legislature to that position, which was the practice at the time. When he returned to New York after his senatorial duties, he worked as a patent lawyer and expected to be the 1816 nominee for president, which, as we know, history tells us, went instead to Abraham Lincoln, a man of the West of Illinois, on the third ballot. Although Lincoln and Seward did not know each other well, they had met once only. Lincoln asked Seward to be his Secretary of State, and Seward was one of the longest serving Secretaries of State in the United States history. He served 8 years. And as listeners may also know, Seward survived an assassination attack on the same evening that Lincoln was shot while at Ford's Theater, April 14th in 1865. We're going to talk about the life of William Seward and the creation of the statue that will be placed again in front of the courthouse here in Juneau on July 3rd. Mary, talk a little bit about the genesis of the idea of why this community should honor William Seward. And we should mention 2017 is the sesquicentennial of the transfer of Alaska from Russia to the United States through a treaty of cession that William Seward oversaw.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, all of it starts with John Venables. I think many of you know John. He's certainly been a character in our community for many, many years. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. But he was the one who talked all the time about statues, famous people. He honored just about everyone he could through his Alaska Living History grant that he received from Rasmussen. He spoke to children and schools, and he talked to many, many organizations. He just liked to talk about famous people, famous Alaskans: Bob Bartlett, Ted Stevens, Susan Butcher, Judge Wickersham, but his very favorite was William Henry Seward. He always said, "I wish we could build a statue of him. I would like that to happen." And then he would end with, "I love statuary." That became somewhat of a quote we like to share about him. So after hearing all of this, we heard from John a lot. He talked a lot to many of us about it. When the state declared that the sesquicentennial event was going to take place in Juneau, and they asked everyone in the state to please have something to recognize this event, it was pretty easy to start thinking about a Seward statue because of what we heard constantly from John Venables. Barbara Probst was the secretary, the assistant to Lieutenant Governor Meade, and Brenda Hewitt worked on the Juneau Community Foundation. And both of them got together and said, I think we can put together a statue project. Everyone seemed to be very interested in that, and we were collectively got together and started to think, how could we put this together? One of the very first thing, of course, was to get permission from the state. The state granted us permission to put a statue on the Courtyard Plaza. We had to sign agreements with the state. The Juneau Community Foundation agreed to be our sponsor, and we signed agreements with that. And then we set out to get a committee, and that was not a difficult thing to do because the committee was almost self-forming. There were so many people who were so excited about this project. And then we had to get ourselves an artist. So we put out RFPs, and we did get a couple of artists send back their RFP, but the one who stood out was David Rubin from Ketchikan. We were thrilled to get a Ketchikan sculptor, and we knew about the work he had done in Ketchikan, the large statue that he did of called the Rock, and so we just definitely were very, very interested in having him be our sculptor. So then we had to start raising funds, and that has been a long process, but we have managed to raise enough to pay our sculptor his asking price, and also to have a little event on July 3rd at 3 o'clock in the Courtyard Plaza, and we hope everyone will come to that. So it just was really started with John Venables, and it led on to many, many people in town wanting to help and see the statue go up in the Courtyard Plaza. It's going to be a lovely statue.
When did this process begin, Mary? How many years has this been underway?
Well, we've definitely been working for 3 years with our sculptor, but it started the year before that when we decided to do this and started working with the state and the Juneau Foundation and started thinking seriously about putting a statue on the Courtyard Plaza. So it's been more than 3 years, 3 to 4 years.
Wayne, you are on the Alaska State Historical Commission. The commission put out a invitation for communities to plan something for the sesquicentennial of the transfer, and you became co-chair of the committee to get the Seward statue to become a reality. Why Seward? Why is he so significant in the eyes of this group to be honored through a statue?
Well, it was interesting. I had an opportunity to participate in an interview with Walter Starr, who's the author of the book you're just reading there in front of you. And at the end of the interview, he was asked, would the Treaty of Session happened if Seward would not have been Secretary of State? And Walter Starr said, absolutely not. He was the right person in the right place at the right time that resulted in the transfer of Russians' interest to the United States. And he thought that a very good possibility that Alaska might not have been part of the United States if it weren't for William Seward. So he is an important person. And as you mentioned in your introduction there, he was very important to the United States. He was a very important part of the history of the U.S. I mean, he was Secretary of State, a very important position during the Civil War, and played a very important role in Lincoln's cabinet. So he had a very significant role in U.S. history, and then, of course, Alaska history, just because being in the right place at the right time. He was also a visionary in that he really wanted to take opportunities to expand the borders of the United States. He wanted to do that through diplomacy rather than through conquest, and he was opposed to the Spanish War that actually ended up with most of the West, Southwest being part of the United States. He was actually opposed to that because he could see that was going to be warfare, and he thought maybe they could deal with it diplomacy. So when Alaska came around as an opportunity, doing it through diplomacy, it was fed right into his interest of how to expand the borders. He also really understood the importance, the future importance that the Pacific was going to have in the United States history. Prior to that time, you know, a lot of the focus was on the Atlantic and commerce with Russia, and he could see that the future opportunities of Alaska with trade and defense and everything else that the Pacific had. The United States is a very interesting location worldwide. It's one of the few countries that fronts both on the Atlantic and the Pacific, and so that you know, carrying on commerce with both through both oceans was going to be something he thought was going to be very important to the U.S. history. So I think he played a very important role in U.S. history and certainly an important role in Alaska history. So his, you know, using that statue as an opportunity to talk about the history of the U.S. and the history of Alaska in the 1860s, 1850s, 1860s, I think it's a good symbol for carrying on what Murray talked about with John Venables, who was very interested in, you know, furthering interest in education in history, and I think this is an opportunity to do that.
It's interesting, in the definitive 500-page biography of Seward, the Alaska Purchase takes up maybe 1%, fewer than 5 pages. Much of the book does focus on Seward's commitment to protecting the rights of African Americans. And in fact, he helped Harriet Tubman buy property near his house. He himself housed fugitives on the Underground Railroad and defended a black man who had been released from prison and had recently been charged with murdering a family nearby. And Seward believed that everybody deserved a defense. And as a trained lawyer, he agreed to mount a defense for this individual, although
that was not a popular position.
A great deal of opprobrium was heaped on him in that process. Right. He did not necessarily believe in the immediate abolition of slavery. As you mentioned, conquest was not how he approached complex issues. He believed that the keeping together the Union was paramount, and that slavery as a condition of servitude would, of its own weight, collapse over time. And his biographers primarily credit him with holding the nation together during the Civil War by convincing, through his position as Secretary of State, those countries who may have become allied with the Confederates, primarily the United Kingdom or Britain at the time, and France, from staying out of involving themselves in the war by either providing materiel or constructing ships or continuing to trade with the South, and most of his energy went to that.
That's correct, and that if either France or Britain in particular had recognized the Confederate States as an independent country as opposed to a part of a country in rebellion, United States may have declared war on them, and we might have had World War One in the 1860s rather than, you know, several decades later.
And two separate independent nations on this continent.
Yeah.
One of the things that occurred in the Civil War that was related to Alaska was the attack by a Confederate ship of a Yankee whaling fleet in the Bering Sea and completely destroyed the whaling ship fleet.
It's interesting that that Alaska was actually involved in the Civil War with the Shenandoah captured and sank dozens of Yankee whalers in the North Pacific. And interesting was that they didn't even know, the people on the Shenandoah didn't know the war was over for months afterwards.
And, of course, we are sitting in a radio studio with the lights on, broadcasting through the blessing of electricity, and we forget that at that time, whale oil was the foundation for a lot of industry as well as interior lighting. And so the whaling industry was something that was prominent during the time that we would not be thinking about necessarily right now. We are going to listen to an interview pre-recorded earlier today with author Mike Dunham. He is a longtime Alaska resident, and in 2016 he published the book The Man Who Bought Alaska, which focuses on Seward. And he declares in the book at the beginning, "One can reasonably say that had Seward not lived, the United States of America, if it still existed at all, would not be the country it is today. Had a chance to talk with Mr. Dunham today for about a half hour. This is an edited version of that interview.
Seward himself said that the purchase of Alaska was his greatest achievement. He also said some other things were his greatest achievements, but he did specifically mention Alaska as being at one time. However, I think most of the major historians who have studied Seward, and there have been many of them, he's the most studied person in the Civil War after Robert E. Lee and Abraham Lincoln, but they would say it was probably his actions during the Civil War era that helped to save the United States, at least three occasions that I can bring up at the top of my head. But the big one is the Trent Crisis, the Cuban Missile Crisis of the 19th century, is how Walter Starr, a recent biographer, put it, where Britain literally came within hours of declaring war on the United States in the middle of the Civil War. Had the ambassador reached his warships off the coast and sailed off to England, there was no way to call him back. It would have been the British Navy sailing into American waters and opening the southern ports for trade and, in both directions, and it would have changed the entire complexion of the war.
We should mention also that Seward was an experienced lawyer. He was trained as a lawyer and became a very successful patent lawyer as well, arguing cases across the United States as well as in front of the United States Supreme Court before he became more deeply engrossed, of course, as Secretary of State. Another strategic reason for Alaska, it seems, that there were communications about laying a communications cable specifically for telegraph through the Arctic, in particular the Bering Sea, as I recall. Can you discuss that strategic approach as well?
Yeah, the idea was to continue the telegraph poles up through Canada, down the Yukon River, and out towards Wales, and then underneath the Bering Sea for a short distance. The problem with laying an oceanic cable was that they always broke and they were hard to repair, but you could do a shorter distance, like the Bering Straits, and then lay another telegraph line halfway across Russia, actually about two-thirds away across Russia, to, I think, Irkutsk, which was as far as it went. But then you could communicate with London via this long route. Seward was very promotional of this. He was trying to get congressional funding to support it. He wrote letters saying this is an important thing. And, it was only the surveying was well underway when the transatlantic cable finally came through and negated the need to put that through. But I do notice with some interest that I think it was just this year an optical cable is laid basically through the Bering Straits. I mean, the plan was just a little ahead of its time in some ways. Again, he was seeing the future in some remarkable ways.
You mentioned the destruction of the Yankee whaling fleet during the Civil War here in Alaska and the Tsar's recognition of the vulnerability of the territory that was held long distance. Talk a little bit about the other side of this picture, and that is the Russian point of view on first coming to Alaska and then releasing it for a relatively inexpensive amount to the United States.
Right. Well, the Russian movement towards the east had pretty well been stopped by the time it got to the Pacific, to the Pacific Ocean, only to be sort of a thread of communication to Alaska itself because of the stormy waters, the fact they were using sailing ships. It was quite a dangerous kind of occupation, and they never were able to make great inroads into the territory that they, on paper, at least controlled. Herbert Hope, who was the late Herbert Hope, former president of the Alaska Native Brotherhood, once told me, he said, "We didn't worry too much about the Russians. There weren't that many of them, and they were afraid of Indians with guns." And so it was more of like a business deal that the Russians had going there. In 1840, they, for instance, had leased their fort at Wrangell to the Hudson Bay Company for a period of 10 years, and it's possible they were looking at this as being something like that. But the Tsar was concerned, I think, about the vulnerability of it. He was getting mixed messages, though. On one hand, you had the fact that Siberia was developing very quickly. They'd found a way to get to the mouth of the Amur River. Vladivostok and Nikolaevsk, two important towns, had been established with help from settlers from Sitka, by the way. And they were thinking this is just too much. We have to concentrate on Siberia and protecting that. Also, there was a a Pacific front to the Crimean War, this enormous world war that Russia was in against France and Britain and Turkey. Most of the action took place there in the Crimea that we remember nowadays, but there was also an assault on Petropavlovsk on the Kamchatka Peninsula. The British and the French were repulsed and went to Victoria to rest up for the season, but if they just steered a couple hundred miles north, they probably could have taken Kodiak and Sitka without firing a shot. So we were that close to the Crimean War. And so that was something. Still, his advisors were saying, don't do this. Don't settle for less than $5 million, is actually what his Secretary of State told him. And they got considerably more because they figured they'd need to bribe senators. But his brother, Constantine, who was heavily invested in Siberia, wanted to see the effort go into Siberia, and he was always bad-mouthing the Russian-American company and trying to get the Tsar to sell. The Russian historian Edvard Radzinsky, author of a good biography on Tsar Alexander II, says, the sale of Alaska is the one thing for which Russians have still not forgiven Alexander II.
Particularly from this vantage, for sure. Russians first made incursions into Alaska in the early 1700s, if I recall, 1741 or thereabouts, and their tenure here lasted about 120 years. In that time, what was the perception of the native people who lived here? Can you summarize that to some degree?
You can break it kind of into two parts. One is the early period there, where there really was no government. It was the Wild East, if you want to look at it that way. There were fur hunters with basically criminals, and they were brutal. They were just, they had guns. They took what they wanted, and they massacred people. There was fighting going on the whole time. But after Baranov, Alexander Baranov comes in as the governor, things change. Those are the last big battles are in Sitka. In 1802, the Tlingits kick the Russians out, massacre the garrison, and are able to hold it for 2 years until Baranov comes back with a very large force, including a warship he just happened to luck into, and actually it was more of a survey ship that just had a couple of cannons on it. And after some serious fighting, the Tlingits withdrew and had their famous survival march across to the other side of the island. Baranov establishes Sitka as a fortified trading post. And in the meantime, the Tlingit chief is on the other side of the island, Katlin, and warning all the other native groups in the area, don't trade with these people until you talk to me, and essentially creating this sort of boycott on the Russian interests. And Baranov and Katlin eventually had to sit down and cut a deal, and then things worked out pretty well. The Indians were, supplying the furs, and the Russians were supplying the goods from the Far East. Essentially, all of a sudden, everybody's eating on China and has these latest Paris fashions, and it was the Haida in the Queen Charlotte Islands are said to have been the richest people ever in the history of the world for a period of about 20 years there in the early 1800s, just because the fur industry was so good. And also, there was a Creole population that began to develop, which was different from the American experience entirely, the mixed-race marriages. And young men from that group were often sent to Moscow to study things like astronomy and navigation and shipbuilding. And they'd come back from the university. Some of them stayed. But they would come back from the university and be this sort of glue holding the Russian government, the Russians, and their native relatives together in a sort of a single community. There was still friction, of course, but it was a different experience than happened with the Americans when the Americans came in and were almost as disgusted with the mixed-race people as they were with the Indians. It should be pointed out, though, that the Tlingits were not like what they had experienced in the Lower 48. There was a high respect for industry, intelligence, culture, and a respect for law, which is one of the things the first American soldiers noticed that they had not expected when they got there.
At the very end of Seward's life, he traveled the world again, including a trip to Southeast Alaska, where I found it interesting that he was asked by Koklux, the head elder and chief of the Chilkats up in Klukwan near Haines, to mediate a dispute between those tribal members amongst their members and those of the Sitka group. Can you describe this? It's one of the last acts that Seward participated in, and always the tactician, which you've noted is also a quality of the Alaska Natives in this region as well. Always the tactician, he was faced with this issue posed to him by the chief at Klukwan. Can you describe this story?
It's an astonishing story to my mind. First of all, that he made the trip. He's one of the first passengers on the Transcontinental Railroad. And he gets to San Francisco, and he's greeted like this reigning king, which is great because he'd left Washington, D.C. As a persona non grata. And they offer him this ship. He takes this trip to Alaska, and as best I can figure out, it is the first time he ever had conversation or met with Native Americans of any kind, at least in his biographies, that's the way it appears. He gets to Sitka, spends a lot of money in the Tlingit side of town, where they already had a gift shop industry up and running, like they could see the future. And then he's offered to go to Klukwan to see an eclipse that's set up there. Koshlux was a very famous leader. The biography of this man needs to be written at some point. He's an astonishing person. He was regarded as a ferocious warrior, but he tended to like to humiliate people more than kill them, if that was possible. He'd gotten in trouble in Sitka, had been put in jail, and the military commander of Alaska asked if he would guarantee the safety of the white men coming to see this eclipse that was taking place in Klukwan, north of Haines. He would let him have his freedom. And Koshlux agreed, maybe because he wanted his freedom, but also he loved to entertain people. He was, I think, kind of famous for that, and he saw the opportunities there. He was a master negotiator. He was very much like Seward in many, many ways. I think the two of them looked each other in the eye and realized they were, they both knew what the other one wanted within about 15 seconds. But it is amazing. After the eclipse has happened, Koshlux says, "Everyone come over to my house," and Seward thinks he's going to be invited for tea. But in fact, it was a very serious business meeting. There was no dancing described or exchange of gifts or anything like that. It was just this very serious discussion. "We got a problem here. People were killed. Justice demands a life for a life. And, you know, but we can't really attack a place that's guarded by your soldiers. What are you going to do about it?" And they go back and forth for the longest time and finally settle on 36 blankets, which is pretty cheap, by the way. Koshlux himself would later trade for upwards of 500 blankets to, you know, end bloodshed one way or the other. But they turned out to be pretty good friends. And then at the end of the, once that's settled, and Seward invites everyone to his ship for a dinner. I don't know how the chefs pulled this off, by the way. And all of Klukwan, anyone who's anyone, shows up at the ship to have dinner with Seward. And Koshlux shows up wearing a neat suit of black broadcloth, which just kind of astonished everybody when he showed up there. And they have a dinner and a discussion, and I think a good deal of humor is shown in what happened there. But Seward left Koshlux with a chinchilla cloak, which would have been probably the most expensive article of clothing anyone would have had in those days, with a tag on it that said, you know, "From his friend William Seward." And Koshlux liked to wear this whenever he had to meet white people.
To conclude our conversation, Mike, what is one thing that our listeners should take away knowing about William H. Seward?
Well, I think the main thing for Alaskans is, I put this at the end of the book, he was the victim of an assassination attempt on the same night that Lincoln was assassinated. The guy sent to kill Seward, his gun did not work. John Wilkes Booth's gun, of course, did. If it had been the other way around, and Lincoln had lived and Seward had died, how would the world be different? I think the United States might have come together, reconciled after the Civil War, more peacefully than has happened. But I don't believe Alaska would be part of the bargain. I think it was Seward's quick action on the night of March 29th, 1867, that succeeded in getting a deal done that was otherwise going to be in limbo and possibly left in limbo for eternity. So that's a very critical thing. And like I say, keeping the Union together during the Civil War is pretty massive. If the United States somehow or it worked out differently and we were a divided country, it's questionable. I mean, I wonder whether we would have had the power to present the force we did, for instance, in World War II, and how that would have changed things. So in many ways, you know, it was $7.2 million. Was it a good deal, bad deal? We made more money in the Juneau gold mine in about 10 years than that by far. But I think the whole thing paid for itself in about 20 minutes over Stalingrad when Russians had planes that had been able to get into the air that had come all the way from the United States through Alaska.
That was author Mike Dunham, whom we spoke with earlier today. He is the author of two books, The Man Who Bought Alaska and The Man Who Sold Alaska. I want to welcome our listeners. If you're just joining us, my name is Lori Scandling. This is Focus on Community, and we have a number of guests this evening, and we're talking about the placement of a statue honoring former Secretary of State William H. Seward downtown in front of the courthouse on July 3rd. Seward facilitated the Treaty of Cessation of the Alaska Territory from Russia to the United States in 1867 in a deal that was perceived to be rather quick and somewhat secretive, inasmuch as it occurred at around midnight on the evening after the minister from Russia approached Seward and let him know that fairly secret negotiations that had been discussed for quite some time were coming to fruition, and that the Minister Steckel had permission then to follow through with Seward on the deal. In the studio with me this evening are a number of guests. Mary Becker, she originated the committee with the help of many others to get a statue of Seward developed. Ishmael Hope is a local activist. Wayne Jensen, who is a local architect and co-chaired the committee to get the statue developed, and he is also on the Alaska State Historical Commission. Also with us is Dr. Norma Shorty. She is an independent Indigenous researcher. We just heard from author Mike Dunham, and later in the program, we'll talk with the sculptor David Rubin from Ketchikan. Ishmael, you mentioned as we were listening to Mike Dunham's description, he referenced a relative of yours. Please describe that relative and provide some additional background on the cessation of the Alaska Territory.
Well, that was my granduncle Herb Hope, Stunuk, and that was the name of actually one of the Kiksuti commanders, that he stepped into that name, granduncle Herb. And he knew that history, and I studied that history as well. I've heard of that history of the Kiksuti battle against the Russians, 1802 and 1804. And I liked what he said there. I actually liked a lot of what he said. He said it was more like a business deal. And what was happening was nations working among nations. And that's the basis of sovereignty. We're going to talk a little bit about decolonization in this program. And I think that's the core of it. It has to do with land and resources and not just something you feel. You know, this ethereal thing. It has to do with justice and doing what's right and having a correct reading of the history. And so if you look at that, what really the situation was, because there wasn't that many Russians, was that they controlled a couple forts. Maybe they had a little bit more control of the Aleutian Islands. Professor Stephen Haycox has written about that. But it was really the native people, for all intents and purposes, really controlled the land. And they came up with a business arrangement with Baranov, and those Russians rarely went outside their fort. And they had hunting and fishing rights on the land. And that was pretty much the arrangement. Maybe there's some people that disagree with me, but we know our history. We hear our history from our elders. And by the time of the Treaty of Cession, that was still happening, this nation-to-nation, sovereign nation-to-sovereign nation dealings. And what was really sold, Fred Paul and William Paul have articulated this very well. There are these very prominent Tlingit lawyers and activists and, with the Alaska Native Brotherhood, that what was really sold was not actually the land itself. It wasn't fee simple. And Kathy Ruddy and Peter Metcalf have also articulated this quite well. It was suzerainty or governance, the right as a so-called nation to another nation to sell the right to govern on that land. It was, and so I know Mike, who I greatly appreciate what he has talked about and written. On his title, it says real estate deal. But in reality, by their own laws, that's not what happened. It was suzerainty and governance. And so that was what was sold And that was the basis of the land claims fights, which ended up culminating in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. It wasn't just the United States kind of wanting to throw a bone to the Native people. There was a legal basis for this. And it had to do with that fact there was not a treaty or a war, an outright war with the people. Although what I will say is something that is largely under-researched and misunderstood is the fact that the United States begun by showing examples, following the example of the Russians, of government-to-government relations. And what Mike just described of Koklux, or actually I believe this is Shadachich, a Kagwantan clan leader from Klukwan, participating in the Kluwakan ceremony, a peace ceremony. And so that is exactly what Steve Langdon, Professor Steve Langdon, calls usable history. We can look at that and see an example of a sovereign nation working with a sovereign nation. There, he was working with Tlingit laws to make a settlement under Tlingit law. And the thing is, what happened, there were bombardments on Wrangell, Cake, and Angoon. And Angoon is the most famous one. And so while there wasn't an outright declaration and change of policy direction, these bombardments proved a change of policy by not willing to go into those kind of negotiations, not willing to deal with people, the Tlingit people, the Native people, as a sovereign nation, like with the settlement with blankets, which happened for many years with the Russians. And like, for example, the United States, as Professor Langdon pointed out, the releasing of salmon streams with clan leaders in southern Tlingit territory. And so they changed that by doing these bombardments when the Tlingit people wanted to do a settlement that have to do with peace ceremony, have to do with restitution that usually ends up with blankets. They changed that by just saying, we're not going to deal with you. You give us blankets, and if you don't, we're going to shell your village, destroy your village. And so really it was what Professor Langdon called state terrorism.
As I recall, in the bombardments of Cake and Angoon and what was the third location?
Wrangell,
thank you. In at least two of those instances, there had been a death of a tribal member, I believe, that had been caused through some series of circumstances by a non-Native military person in the area. And what, as we read looking back, appears to be some deep misunderstanding about what that restitution process was. And that seems in those cases, for at least Cake and I think Angoon, resulted then in this show of force rather than a process of negotiation.
Absolutely. And that's what the Tlingit people were used to doing. I think misunderstanding is the way that Cyril George characterized it. It was a clear change in how laws are interpreted, how the relationship with people would be enacted. And the Tlingit people operating under expectations they've had since time immemorial when dealing with another tribe or another nation, which they did with the Russians and started with the United States. And that just suddenly stopped. And this destruction happened. And so the people, I would imagine, felt that force, felt that shell shock and that trauma, and that started that change. But there was no declaration of war. It was an underlying, undeclared, unspoken thing, where they used excuses of drunkenness or, you know, someone got murdered. So, but if someone gets murdered, then do you destroy the whole village? I mean, that was the problem with that whole situation.
Your analogy of the nation-to-nation negotiations is interesting and fully fits with how Seward's job unfolded for the 8 years, primarily in the first 5 years as Secretary of State. He understood this nation-to-nation negotiation and that was how things got resolved.
Well, I think, the Native people may have complicated feelings about a statue coming up. I'm not going to, you know, I have no personal judgment really on that, but I think it's just, we just need to understand the history. I think Seward did not Purchase Alaska as the stereotype is. And I think in addition to participating in that peace ceremony, there were other instances like there's the famous Seward shame pole. And the little that I've heard of that from Israel Shotridge and the people in Ketchikan, the Teikwedi, who had that, it really had to do with that. He was going to be an honor guest at a party, and he didn't show up. And so that again, that's an example of working with Tlingit nations, their clan system, their ways of doing things, and Seward having some kind of participation in that. So I think there's some positives there. And I think that kind of dealings with the people, it could be a model even in some ways for us to study.
Thank you. Dr. Nirma Shorty is with us, and she is Tlingit as well from the Teslin region, and she serves on the Arctic Council's Subcommittee on Sustainability. She also is an author of curriculum with the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. Nirma, when writing curriculum for young people in the school system, both Native and non-Native, to understand colonization and decolonization, can you describe what that involves in terms of helping youth get a broader picture of history?
Well, I think one of the things that we started with when we did our work with the Gold Belt Heritage Elders, we began with the boarding school topics. And true to Indigenous ways of doing things, the topic was very focused, but what came out was very broad. And so we began to discuss other things besides boarding schools, and it was all of the policies since the time of colonization or contact. So going back to 1763 in Canada, you know, the French Indian War, and from that what happened was Jay Treaty. So it allowed people like myself to come over to the Alaskan side, the American side, to work and live, because the borders took away our family connections and all of these things. Of course, the battles that Ishmael already talked about, Indian Civilization Act, the Bureau of Indian Affairs going up in 1824, Indian Removal Act in 1830, International Manifestation Destiny 1867, the Purchase of Alaska in 1867, the shelling of Cake and Wrangell, Carlisle Indian School opens, Juneau was founded, the Organic Acts, all of these things, Major Crime Acts, the Dawes Act, these things displaced Indigenous peoples over a long period of time. So while there may not have been a war, it was all of the policies that really did, in a way, separate Indigenous peoples from their land, from their history, from their culture. And so when we're rebuilding our historical way of knowing, we do so with our elders and in a way that embraces our methods. And how we share that out is we put it in our public school curriculum so that we're not focusing so much on Anne Frank in grade 5, but we're focusing on what happened in Douglas with regard to our grave site. We just raised a totem pole over there. So it is to take away so much the mystery of colonization and all of that, and bringing it to a deeper understanding in our public school system. And so it's not only that we're teaching our children, but our teachers are also needing to be trained and to be responsive. And so I find that our community here in Juneau is very willing to work towards this endeavor, and we have been very diligently in all of our efforts.
I wanted to share a few sentences of a poem. Coincidentally, the Alaska State Museum is featuring a show called Decolonizing, which features nearly 30 artists who are Indigenous and not Indigenous with a variety of expressions along this topic. And I wanted to share a few sentences written by Sven Hackinson about decolonizing. And this is how he frames it: stripping our humanity one act at a time through generations, not knowing, not seeing, not hearing, never aware, how one policy built on another and another erased our humanity, our beliefs, our ways, our being, our words in two generations. Outsiders knowingly, unknowingly enacting policies, creating legacies of actions, erasing our past in the present. And I think that captures much of what you just described in the timeline of those policies that developed and then affected Alaska. Let's take a moment and talk with the sculptor David Rubin, who is from Ketchikan, as Mary Becker, who helped initiate the process of getting the Seward statue to come to reality, mentioned. It was a pleasure for the committee to be able to hire an Alaskan artist, and I'd like to welcome Mr. Rubin to the program. Thank you for joining us this evening.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Glad, yes, we can, and we're glad to have you with us. I wanted to ask you about any of the challenges in bringing an historical figure to life through metal. We're talking about Seward's life here. We're talking about his activities as Secretary of State, as a person who visited Alaska and met the Alaska Native people and others affected by the cessation treaty. What were your challenges in showing who this person, a person of flesh and blood, is through an inanimate form?
Well, what was particularly interesting and challenging about this portrayal of Seward is that it was decided, I don't know if you heard the panel discussion that was held about a year and a half, 2 years ago, about how Mr. Seward should be shown with the disfigurement that he suffered from that attack on the night of April 14th, 15th. That to not show the disfigurement would be akin to revisionist history, where we, you know, don't show and don't include the uglier parts of our history, as would have been the case if we portrayed him in his, you know, handsomer, younger state. But when he came to Alaska, it was 2 years after the attack, and he suffered a terrible, terrible disfigurement. His jaw had been dislocated and broken, and he only had two photographs, I think, taken of himself after that. So it was decided that we should show him as he was, as much as we could, when he came to Alaska, because actually when he showed up and the Tlingit people saw him, they said, oh, here comes a great warrior who's come through battle, faced death, and survived. Because that's how they viewed him. His vanity, you know, prevented him from actually appreciating that about himself. But they saw it, and they heralded it. And, you know, he was great friends with Chief Ko Klux, as John Denham correctly said his name. He was here in Ketchikan last week, and I went to see his presentation. But Chief Ko Klux carved Seward's name in his arm to show his great appreciation, gratitude, and, you know, respect for this man. I think they were very much like each other. And, you know, Israel Shotridge, Ko Klux was a Shotridge.
Yeah.
And I was at the Shame Pole raising here in Ketchikan a few weeks ago. And Stephen Jackson, Nathan Jackson's son, did the second copy of the original pole. And Willard Jackson, Israel's older brother, who was also a Shotridge, came up to me and said that he felt that it was 150 years ago and that the most important thing for him to concentrate on now was his children and his grandchildren. He didn't really feel that to hold on to that grudge anymore. And I asked him if that story was true about the chief carving Seward's name in his arm. He said, yes, it is. It was true. So I guess there's a lot of different feelings towards Seward in Alaska, but the story from, you know, Fuquan is that he was greatly, greatly, greatly appreciated. And, you know, Mr. Ko Klux, Chief Ko Klux, I'm sure remembered him his whole life. His name was right there carved in his own flesh. So that was the exciting thing to portray. I don't think he's ever been portrayed with his disfigurement.
I don't know if the public knows that. They may be aware that Seward was a target on the same night that Lincoln was shot. But what they may not know is that Seward was already seriously injured and in bed convalescing from a near life-threatening carriage accident in which he jumped out of a carriage to help a runaway team of horses, and he himself was thrown to the ground broke his face in number of places, and he was in bed convalescing with the help of his grown children when a man whose gun did not work and misfired broke into the house, pushed back his grown children, and began to use a knife to stab Seward in the head, neck, and face while Seward was in bed and tried to roll away from the assailant. So when you refer to his disfigurement, it was in his face and neck. It was quite obvious. It was something that was not easily hidden.
Right. Not easily hidden. And what happened was that he was riding in the carriage that Sunday with his family, and the door to the carriage kept swinging open, and he alerted the coachman to this, and they pulled over, and the coachman got off his perch on the seat and let go of the reins, and the horse took off, and Seward was still in the carriage, and he tried to, you know, grab the reins and save his family, and he got thrown from the carriage, and he smashed on his face. He dislocated his jaw, broke his jaw, and he was lying in bed. That was 9 days before the attack, before the assassination of Lincoln, and the attack on him. It was 9 days before, and he was wearing a metal brace around his neck, and they think that's what saved his life, because Lewis Powell, his assassin, you know, had come in the house with a gun that had misfired, and so he used a Bowie knife when he broke into Seward's room and was stabbing in the face, but he didn't get him in the neck. Because of the metal brace that was there, placed there by the doctors that tried to reconstruct his jaw. So really the accident is what saved his life. And, the gun misfiring, of course, I mean, like was mentioned before, if that hadn't happened, there'd probably be no Alaska. Well, there wouldn't have been part of the United States.
David, what are you most satisfied with at the end of this project? Seward now lies in a storage box here in Juneau, ready to be erected. I understand he will be a few inches taller than he was in real life. What gave you satisfaction as you stood back and looked at your final work?
That it was finished.
How long did it take you?
Well, I guess we... just almost 3 years. You know, we did it, by the way, in the basement of the house where I grew up. My sister and I, my sister lives in Boston. I live, of course, here in Ketchikan. And the house where we grew up is in Ardsley, New York. Now, that's about an hour and maybe 20 minutes from Florida, New York, where Seward was born. And my sister and my mother, just by coincidence, got to tour his house, the house where he was born, on his birthday, because after the first 2 weeks that I spent back there working on the statue, I was going to leave from Logan Airport in Boston. I was going to drive back to Boston with my sister, and she realized, wow, May 16th, I think that's Seward's birthday. And I said, wow, we should go to Florida, New York. They're probably having a whole bunch of festivities up there, which they were. So we called up and came up there, and we had a personal tour of his house, and that was very exciting. And there is a bust of Seward in that town, by Daniel Chester French, who's the artist who sculpted the Great Lincoln Memorial, and which is very exciting to be there on his birthday, and right by where we. And just a little thing, you know, Ardsley, the town where I grew up, is named after Cyrus Field. Lived in the town over from Ardsley, and Ardsley was along the aqueduct from north up in the Catskills, where it was bringing water to Manhattan, was coming through Ardsley, and they couldn't figure out the engineering. And they asked Mr. Field if he could help them, and he said, I will help you with that. If you change your name from Ashford, New York, to Ardsley, New York, my family's ancestral home. So you brought up the transatlantic cable. Well, it was actually laid by the engineer for that, Cyrus Field. He was the reason that my town, Ardsley, got its name, because he lived in the town nearby. But
one degree of separation. We're talking with David Rubin. He is the sculptor of the William H. Seward statue.
With my sister, too, by the way.
Yes,
my sister Judy.
Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate that. We have just, thank you, David. We have just a few minutes, and I would like to pose to each of our guests who are live here in the studio the question I posed to author Mike Dunham, and each have just about a half a minute. As visitors and local people look at the Seward statue once it is erected, I asked Mr. Dunham what should be a takeaway thought that we keep in mind as we look at the depiction of this person in United States history who had a huge impact then later on what transpired in Alaska. And if you would each take a half moment, what would you like somebody to keep in mind as they look at the Seward statue once it is erected July 3rd? Who would like to go first? And we just have about 3 minutes. Ms. Becker.
Thank you. I think one thing I hope people think about is that if you're a visionary and you believe in something strongly, you're able to accomplish a lot. I hope our young people remember that.
Thank you,
they're
Mary.
Growing up.
Ishmael?
Well, decolonization has to do with land and resources and a sovereign nation working with another sovereign nation. And I think Seward showed a couple examples of that. And I also think we need far more Native monuments. We need the Native people to be front and center in these conversations and dialogues. Gunashish.
Wayne.
I think I'll go back to one of the things I mentioned initially about this is an opportunity to learn about history, and to accompany the statue will be two informative panels, two interpretive panels that talk a lot about what we talked about here tonight. It'll talk about Seward's history, the treaty, his travel here, and his association, his interaction with the Native people. A lot of that will be on the panel. So, I would encourage people to read those panels. And the statue is a symbol for an opportunity to, enlarge our history. There's a book was mentioned earlier, and I would encourage people to read that. It's called A Dangerous Idea. It was written by Peter Metcalf and Kathy Ruddy. It's an excellent book, and it talks a lot about what Ishmael was talking about. And I think that's worth commending.
Thank you, Wayne. And Dr. Shorty, a thought that folks should keep in their mind as they're looking at this statue.
One thing I would really like to encourage people to think about is to ask themselves the question, where are the local heroes and where are their statues and where are the place names? Where are the indigenous place names of this area and what does that really mean? So I know working with the elders I work with, these are the burning desires that they have in their hearts is to see that come to fruition.
And Ishmael, if you want to look for some new statues, I'm your man.
All right, I'll get on it.
Get Wayne on board, for sure.
I'd like to see one of Koklux, for sure.
He sounds like...
Koklux would be excellent.
You know? As Mike Dunham said, an astonishing figure. Mm-hmm. Thank you all for joining us on A Focus on Community. My name is Laurie Scandling, and we appreciate your listening to our program this evening.
Join us on Tuesday night for a screening of the documentary Lineage, Tlingit Art Across Generations, a 360 North and K2 Public Media film made possible by a grant from the Alaska Humanities Forum. After the screening, co-director Ishmael Hope will be joined by artists from the documentary for a multimedia presentation and discussion about Tlingit art. Admission is free on Tuesday, June 20th at 6 p.m. at 360 in the K2 building.